We get things underway this afternoon by welcoming onto the program for the very first time a professor of history at Princeton University, the author of a number of books, including One Nation Under God and Fault Lines, his latest, and as I consider him a tireless crusader for truth in the place where it's hard to find, out there on Twitter, Kevin M. Cruz joins us this afternoon. Kevin, thank you for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We often ask, America asks, how did we get here? And in your wonderful book, you point out that this is a journey that began several decades ago to get to the point we're at today.
That's right, yeah. And so this is a book that I co-wrote with Julian Zelizer, who's another professor at Princeton University in the Department of History. And we look back to try to figure out where our current climate of division comes from. And it's easy to, you know, we could roll back as historians do back as far as we want to go. But we really see a critical moment here in the 70s, and that's where we start our story.
And there are several different lines that we hit that are divided economically, racially, politically, and also a sexual divide.
That's right. Yeah, those are the big four ones that we trace, and we move from the 1970s up to the present day, and really see the way in which America has come apart along those big lines of division.
One of the things that I think is very interesting, and you've talked about this in your earlier book, we often look at the role that religion has played, and as you've pointed out earlier, this idea of a Christian America that in many ways started in the 1930s and really found full flower in the 50s, was an outgrowth of corporate America and their response to what Roosevelt was doing in the New Deal.
Yeah, that's right. And this is something that I think a lot of Americans take for granted because they hear it so often, this suggestion that America is formally and officially a Christian nation. Certainly from the founding, America had been a nation largely populated by Christians. But the founding fathers made it quite clear that the country that they were forming was not going to be a formal Christian nation. And this was a departure from the way in which countries had existed in Europe, where you had a formal church. The First Amendment has a no established religion. It provides for free exercise of religion. There's a clause in the Constitution that was radical at the time, that we wouldn't have any religious tests for office holders. That was something that was remarkably radical when the Constitution was written. And soon after the Constitution is passed, in one of the first treaties that America signs, the Treaty of Tripoli, a treaty begun by George Washington, signed by John Adams, and ratified by a Senate whose membership was half-filled with signers of the Constitution, that treaty says explicitly, the government of the United States is in no sense founded on the Christian faith. So they were quite clear about this. And what I argue in that earlier book, One Nation Under God, is that this idea that the government was formally Christian is something that really takes root starting in the 1930s, but really comes about in the 1950s. And all the things that we would point to now as signs of our government having religious traits, things like Under God in the Pledge of Allegiance, or In God We Trust being the national motto, or the National Prayer Breakfast, or all these things that these signs and ceremonies and symbols we have today, they're all really created in the 1950s. These aren't things that come from the founding fathers. They come from our grandfathers.
Some politicians have been successful at taking advantage of these divides in America. And you point out in the book, Nixon's people talked about what they called the politics of positive polarization. That seems like an oxymoron.
Absolutely. First of all, it's one of those many alliterative phrases that Pat Buchanan and William Safire crafted for the administration. They loved alliteration. What I meant by the politics of positive polarization was that it would be positive for them that if you could find a way to get the country to fight with itself, if you could turn Americans against one another, as long as your side was about 51% or more, you would come out on top, right? And so you could mobilize your base and get them angry at other people. In this case, they were going to get their base, the silent majority, angry at anti-war radicals, at hippies, at civil rights activists, at minorities. And if you could channel their rage towards them, they would vote for you and you would come out on top.
One of the ways we got here is because, as you point out, many Americans lost their trust in government institutions. Did that begin with Vietnam? Where do you trace those origins?
Yeah, there's a series of events in the mid-60s to early 70s that really just start to tumble that. That's one of the reasons we start the story in 1974, because that's when Richard Nixon resigned to the Watergate scandal. And that is really one of the big blows to faith in government. Nixon, who's been elected, reelected by a landslide margin in 1972, is driven for office for his crimes in 74. His vice president, Spiro Agnew, had to resign for his own crimes in 1973. Other congressmen are revealed to be corrupt at the same time. Wilbur Mills, there's the Abscam scandal in the late 70s. Vietnam is another huge one. And again, when that war winds down for America in 1975, it's seen as a huge blow to American prestige. And as Americans came to learn that the war had really been sold on a lot of false premises, they come to distrust the government there too. They also distrust larger institutions and the economy or the media. There's just a general wave of lack of faith in American institutions at this period.
We're talking with Kevin Cruz here on Downtown. You also point out the role the media has played in many ways that began with CNN, the birth of the 24-hour news cycle, and then narrowcasting of folks who aim their programming at a specific group, not to illuminate their lives, but to tell them that what they believe is absolutely correct.
Yeah, that was one of the really fascinating through lines of this book for us, is that we started to focus in on the media, and we realized that the media was a vital story in this, the way in which the media changes. And so this is the period where you really do have a kind of monolithic, what we call now the mainstream media, right? You've got basically three big television networks, and you've got a handful of major metropolitan newspapers, and together they basically set the tone for the national conversation. They provide a basic, agreed-upon set of facts. They provide a kind of down-the-middle interpretation of those. And it's kind of a standard starting point for the way in which Americans understand their world and consume information and act upon it. That starts to fracture over this period. And CNN, as you note, is a really important early change in this, where suddenly you have, with the advent of cable TV, you have a variety increasingly of different news options. MTV is the one that pioneers that term narrowcasting, as opposed to broadcasting, where you're trying to bring in as many people as possible. You really are trying to slice and dice them, right? And so you zero in on a particular market. And then when it comes to news, what that means is that you're zeroing in on we're just going to have a conservative news channel over here. We'll just have a liberal news channel over here. We'll have this channel there. And you can find your own perspective and get your views basically reflected back to you by cable TV.
I thought you and Julian made a great point when you talk about Donald Trump and his rise, and you say that he is the product of this division, not the producer.
Yeah, that's right. We started this book. In fact, most of it was written before Donald Trump was even a candidate. We had a full draft of this in place by 2015. I remember we had bracketed off in the last, well, it's going to be the last chapter. I bracketed off 2016 election here. And I thought a paragraph or two will wrap this up easily, right? Yeah, how naive. And of course, that election turned out to be an incredibly tumultuous one. And so we added a whole new chapter and then an epilogue on the first year and a half of the Trump presidency. But I say that just to explain that, again, this book wasn't about, you know, how we got to Trump. Rather, Trump was really a sign of these developments that we saw all along the way. Political polarization, the growing chorus about the problems of economic inequality and anxiety, the way in which the media landscape was fractured, racial divisions, divisions over gender. He really played into all of these trends that were already on the way. And so we're going to deal with these trends even after his presidency, I think.
So how do we begin to go in the other direction and build those bridges, as you say, between these often polarized camps in America?
Well, I think we're starting to see some signs of that. One of the big themes of the book is that, if we focus on Washington, D.C., things can often seem to be, you know, a paralyzed or one side is dominating the other. If you look at the grassroots, you can see throughout this period different social movements moving up. And in fact, modern conservatism was really one of these social movements that built up in the late 70s and took power, and Trump was maybe the product of that. We're starting to see new changes here, putting new things on the national agenda, whether it be the Me Too movement or Black Lives Matter or things like that. And whether I don't think we're ever going to entirely get over these divisions, But I think we can maybe look at what's led us to this point and try to move in the other direction. And that might mean thinking about how we consume our media, thinking about how we construct our politics, move beyond gerrymandering to move beyond voter suppression and really kind of realize the full potential of democracy to really bring everyone to the table, I think might help paper over some of these problems.
What sets Trump apart, as you mentioned in the book, is not necessarily his politics. Many of the things he did early in his presidency, any Republican likely would have done in that situation. It's his demeanor. It's the way he's comported himself in the office. But people seem to like that. So I wonder, when he disappears from the scene, I always think back to the only thing I learned about science: nature abhors a vacuum. Will there be somebody who will step into that role and replace him?
I'm sure there will be, and we saw this in the 2018 midterms. There were a lot of candidates who tried to replicate the kind of the Trump appeal. A lot of them failed, though. I'm not sure it's a model that can really be replicated. In fact, what we might see, I could see a successful candidate for 2020 running on a promise that, hey, you're not going to think about me all the time. I'm not going to be in your face with tweets, and I'm not going to dominate the national discussion. You'll forget who's president for days at a time. I think that could actually be a winning message.
That sounds so refreshing, the way you say that. Like, that could actually be America again. I will say this, Kevin, I love following you on Twitter. If you just got paid by the number of times you've had to correct Dinesh D'Souza, you could retire now.
Oh, man, that'd be nice. If you could arrange that, I would love that.
We're working on that, definitely. Listen, we have this, we consider it our faculty here at our show, and they're history folks that we call on a regular basis. People like Joanne Freeman at Yale, Bill Brands down in Texas, Michael Powell with The Times, Ken Burns, Doris Kearns Goodwin. We'd love to have you be part of that group and come back and visit us again down the road. It's been great talking with you.
Hey, it's been great talking to you. I'd be honored to come back.
Thank you so much. We wish you much success. The book is terrific, Fault Lines. Kevin Cruz, thanks again for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me. Take care.